Hello, everybody. I'm John Atack, as usual, and I am delighted to welcome Jen Senko. And I can't remember when it was I first watched the brainwashing of my dad, but I was really impressed. And so over the weekend, I watched it again, and I was even more impressed. So it's just a brilliant documentary, and I thoroughly recommend it to all and sundry. So
yeah, thank you. Thanks.
Would you like to tell the people a little bit about the documentary and what brought it out, and your lovely father, who, what a remarkable man.
Yeah, I kind of had to make this documentary if it was the last thing that I did on Earth, and it almost was. I got pneumonia, I got shingles. It was it took a toll on my health, but I'm glad I did it. Yeah. So shortly after my dad retired, he partly retired, he got a part-time job, like 3 days a week, but it had a long commute. So he found talk radio because he always wanted to educate himself. But it was Bob Grant. So I don't know if you know, he's in America, he's the godfather of conservative combat radio. And he was openly sexist and openly racist. He said some horrible things. Anyway, when my dad fully retired, like a year or two later, it was probably the end of the 80s, he found Rush Limbaugh. Now, Reagan had kind of destroyed the fairness doctrine in 87. And just a year later, Rush Limbaugh went national, wreaking havoc.
And maybe for our non-US audience, you could tell us what the Fairness Doctrine was before it was destroyed by Reagan.
Oh, okay, the Fairness Doctrine was a genius enactment by FDR to create diversity in radio ownership. I mean, radio, and there wasn't TV back then. But anything to do with broadcast, basically he didn't want a conglomeration, just like one or two people owning it and dominating the media. So it was supposed to be fairness and diversity of ownership. So when Reagan destroyed that, it was pretty harmful. And then Rush Limbaugh was like one of the casualties. I mean, he was, you know. So my dad, having been addicted, so because he was vulnerable, I mean, we can get into the whys and the hows later, which after reading your book, I was just really, it just even fed my mind more. I was really excited. I think your book is brilliant.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for making me read it. It was like a homework assignment. Anyway, he was in transition. He had this whole new life. So he filled his time partly with Rush Limbaugh, listening to him for 3 hours a day, and his personality radically changed. So did all his beliefs. Previous to that, he had been a open-minded, almost like hippie prototype person. Embarrassing my mother because he'd be like, who cares? You know, just do it as long as it doesn't harm anybody else. And he turned into and he was always whistling and happy and talking to strangers with accents because he could speak about 7 different languages.
Oh, wow.
And after he started listening to Rush Limbaugh, he became really anti-immigrant, really, really angry, very argumentative. His whole, it was interesting. It was like invasion of the body snatchers, you know, like there's my dad and his body, but what happened to him? You know, and if I came down from New York to visit them, he'd pick me up in his car. I called it like a crap mobile that had stickers all over it, you know, against Clinton. And, but he'd have Rush Limbaugh blasting on that, you know, So anyway, it was really quite traumatizing for our whole family to see how he changed. And around that time, I started getting interested in politics. And I liked Clinton. I didn't like Reagan. I mean, looking back, I see how Clinton was, you know, center-right and did a terrible thing with the Telecommunications Act in 1996. It's terrible. My dad hated Clinton. And he also, then when email came in, he started sending us all of these emails. And I started seeing a pattern. And the emails were basically differently worded things of what Rush Limbaugh was saying. They were always, the main thing was demonizing Democrats, like under any kind of umbrella, you know, whether it was African Americans or poor people, whatever, anything that Democrats stood for, that was against that. He hated Democrats, and we were all middle of the road Democrats. So it was quite a nightmare. And I thought, I had done a couple documentaries, and I thought, in addition to it being horrifying, it was interesting, like sociologically, to see this transformation that my father went through. Yep. Like, how could this happen? I never would have imagined it. And what, how could he be this influenced? And also, what's going on with all of this poison and this hatred? And it was so obvious to me there was some connection between all of these things, the email, and then the snail mail he got, and you know, the radio. And I thought back then I want to, you know, do a documentary about this. But so part of the documentary was, a good part of it was discovering that there was a plan. There was a vast right-wing conspiracy. Mm-hmm. And now I can say it, you know, kind of plainly out in the open. You know, Hillary had the balls to say it back in, was it 87, 90, 97, 98, something like that. Yeah.
Some time ago, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And was, you know, sharply criticized for it. But that, that basically a libertarian, Republicans and oligarchs saw the country changing, you know, especially after Brown v. Board of Education. That's when it started. They didn't like what FDR did, and they just finally started planning. And this was part of a really brilliant, comprehensive plan to turn the country to the right. So I looked at things like Roger Ailes and his influence over Nixon, and his design when he was working in the Nixon White House, and even designing how the Christmas tree should look, you know, like every aspect, you know, was all PR. And he made Nixon try and sound like a little warmer and fuzzier. You know.
Good luck with that.
Yeah. Exactly. He did train him well in the art of the soundbite. But anyway, he wrote this, we don't know if he wrote it or not, but this memo he was handing around the White House, it had to do with how to get the GOP news on television. It wasn't so much about reporting GOP news, you know, Republican news. It was about converting people to vote Republican.
Yeah.
So that was something, you know, if you think like, okay, that was intent. And then, you know, in 96, Rupert Murdoch hires him to construct Fox News. And then there was Reagan and the Fairness Doctrine. Oh, and the Lewis Powell memo. I don't want to be boring and go into too much detail, but which I could go into a lot of detail. But anyway, there are all these things along the way. Clinton and the Telecommunications Act, which basically opened up anybody. It was a free for all. Anybody could buy as much media as they wanted, and that was a big get for the right. But then anyway, I go into a lot of this, and then years later I wrote the book because I was so fascinated with it. I did even more research and read some great books like Nancy MacLean's Democracy in Chains, and Shadow Network by Ann Nelson, and just other books which like really filled it all out to me. It was very, very apparent. There was this really humongous plan. But the good news is, at the end of the movie, there's a little surprise. There's a very good ending.
Spoiler alert.
Yes, spoiler alert. But I think for the purpose of our discussion and who you are and what you talk about, I'm going to tell it. So my parents moved to a senior community. This was in the 2000s. And in the move, my dad's radio broke somehow. I don't know how, but it broke. And it ended up in the garage. Mm. And gee, he couldn't listen to the radio at lunchtime. So he and my mom started eating lunch together again. Or he would just watch what she had on the television. So immediately, without Rush Limbaugh, he's softened. He just became more tolerable. And that was a very interesting thing. Mm-hmm. Less argumentative. So I started visiting a lot more. And this is when I started making the film, you know, because I thought, oh, I can approach him without him getting too angry. Like, instead of angry like a tornado, he'd be like just a little angry. So then the television in the kitchen conked out, you know, like the old people, there's old television, old radios. And my mother loved programming remotes. And she programmed the remotes, right? And she had stickies all over them, and my dad just didn't want to deal with it. So he watched what she watched. Okay. So then he's even more mellow, and he's not arguing politics anymore, but he's still getting the emails. So once in a while, he's still send zingers to the whole family, you know, and everybody's like, oh, Dad, please stop it. We're going to block you, blah, blah, blah. But one day, he had to go into the hospital for a kidney stone, and he was there for a week, and they had these old clunky computers. And my mom said, Jennifer, why don't you kill some of Daddy's emails, because they're going to clog up the computer. And I started to do it. And then I said, Mom, they just keep coming. So she got the idea of unsubscribing him from a lot of these radical right-wing emails, and then got the idea of subscribing him to some more liberal and progressive ones like Truthout, Alternet, reader-supported news. And they just kind of mixed in. And when he came home, he just read everything. And his personality changed back. And it was like a miracle, because these were the last years of his life, the last few years of his life. And he was happy, he was singing, he was whistling. And the most interesting thing is one day he said to my mom, I like that guy Obama. And she called me up on the phone and told me he said that. No, I don't believe that. And anyway, we celebrated his birthday on Halloween, and that was when his birthday was. And she brought it up again, I think, to show me. And she said, so who are you going to vote for? And he said, Obama. And, you know, it was so it was a real complete story.
Mm.
It was had several layers, mm. you know, with the conspiracy going on and, you know, my dad's story and his transition and mm. change and his change back. And so, yeah, that's the spoiler alert.
Yeah. And in everybody, you still have to watch it because it's absolutely packed with fascinating detail. And I mean, I came away from it with a real affection for both of your parents, for your mum's tolerance of all of this and the cleverness that went into resolving it. And quite evidently, your father was a wonderful man. There's a point where you talk about him giving money to a beggar and calling the beggar sir, you know, showing respect to the beggar. And to be transformed from that into spewing forth hate on so many topics.
Yeah.
And I think for me, the important takeaway is your dad, as you prove in the documentary, is by no means an isolated case. You reached out and you found lots of people who'd had a similar experience, people whose parents, you know, wouldn't talk to them anymore because they voted for Obama and it puts us into a situation. I think we need to be very alert to this. That as a kid, there were two things that confused me as a teenager. There were two things that really confused me. The first was, how could Jack the Ripper have done what he did? You know, the most famous of serial killers, but the mutilation, all of this horrible stuff. How could a human being do that to somebody else? That made no sense to me. And the other was, how could a man like Adolf Hitler have influenced the entire German-speaking world so profoundly that they were willing to not only turn a blind eye to atrocities, but commit atrocities? And there's a misquotation from Voltaire, which is people who believe absurdities will commit atrocities. He didn't quite say that. But thankfully, the second Prime Minister of India, Radhakrishnan, did say it. And I think it's a very important point. And it takes us to, how do we come to believe? And we have all of these ideas of brainwashing, mind control, coercive control, exploitative persuasion. And they're all relevant, but they're amplifications of normal processes. And if somebody controls your information, they control you. When Edward Bernays, who is very much at the beginning of much of this, when he first heard of what Goebbels was saying in Germany on the radio, he said, he's read my book. And the book is called Propaganda.
Did read his book?
Oh, I'm pretty sure that because there was so little literature at the time, I suppose the other pundit was Ivy Lee, but he didn't write a book. So of course there was a tremendous influence from Mussolini and the Italians, who were also working in similar ways. But Bernays is the star of this field in the 1920s. He has no competition. A double nephew of Sigmund Freud, who had contacted Freud and said, "How can I manipulate people?" And he basically says, "Look, of course we need democracy, but people aren't educated enough yet. So for the meantime, we need to sell them sex so that they'll do what we clever people think they ought to do. And then one day they'll be educated enough." Now, that was 100 years ago. And I'm pretty sure that we're still not educated enough as far as he'd be concerned, because you have to agree with such a person to go along. And what we've seen more and more is in society around the world, but particularly in the US as an outsider, this division and this divisiveness that so many politicians, I mean, Barack Obama tried to create a non-partisan government, but it doesn't seem possible in the United States anymore. I was very surprised. I became fascinated by Donald Trump as soon as he, as soon as he announced his candidacy. I started watching everything I could about Donald Trump. He was just this unbelievable character, you know, it was as if Disney had sort of created him somehow. This man whose name, well, it means fart, you know, Trump. So it was sort of, is this real? Is this true? And so much of what was said about him was being said by his friends. You know, his friends were saying, you know, this is the way he behaves. They weren't opponents to him. Mm-hmm. And it was as if we'd sort of crossed a line. Let me also say that I too, in retrospect, I am not a big fan of Bill Clinton. Extraordinary rendition, torture sites, this kind of stuff, war crimes, stopping welfare, first time a president had intervened. But there is this point where it becomes, I mean, as George W. Bush said over the invasion of Afghanistan, you're either with us or against us. There's no room for any shades of belief. You're this or you're that. You're the opponent or you know, the Satan, to use the biblical term for an opponent. Or you are with we godly good people. And at that point, my heart sinks. Now, during the Clinton campaign, a man called Philip Gould traveled over from the UK and was on the campaign and watched everything that was done. And he took the campaign methods and brought them to New Labour under Tony Blair. And Tony Blair won his election in 1997 by using techniques that had been refined during the Clinton campaign. So let me sort of say, I don't trust either side in this division. I think that what's happened is, so we had lots of spin doctors. We had Alistair Campbell, Derek Draper, Philip Gould, and they wrote books about how they'd conned us, as if they, you know, they were boasting about how they'd managed to get us to vote for their politicians. And I started going, I would like to see consensus politics. I would like to see a point where we think about things and talk about things, where we put down the megaphones and stop swearing at each other and come to conclusions that are helpful for all of us. And we are seeing it split further and further apart. And then comes QAnon, and this place where there doesn't seem to be any reality left anymore. There's just spin. There are just these surreal tales that are being told about other people. And it gets ever more confusing because, of course, we then have Fancy Bear and APT-10, APT-28, the Chinese and Russian agencies. And we know that there's a policy within Russia that comes from Alexander Dugin, one of Putin's supporters, of divide and conquer. And so you give money to the nutcases. Alexander Dugin is one of those nutcases. He founded the National Bolshevik Party, which takes all of the best elements of National Socialism and Stalinism and brings them together. I'm not aware of any good elements in those teachings. And at first, he's funded by Putin because if you fund the crazies, by contrast, you'll look sensible. Then Dugin becomes an advisor to Putin. And we have this whole idea of neo-traditionalism in Russia where, Dugin is very confusing, but eventually after reading about 100 pages of his philosophy, I realized that what he wants to do is to return us to the Middle Ages, that we need serfs again, and yeah. Neo-traditionalism will be a return to this where the church will rule everything. And of course, the Russian Orthodox Church is now completely separate from all of the other Orthodox churches. They've all denounced Basil the Patriarch. But we have this idea of an oligarchy, of a plutocracy, of a small group ruling elite. And they're willing to tell any lie at all. So we now have this, you know, I do seek to talk with people who believe these ideas and try and understand how they've come to them. As I say, I'm nonpartisan. I do generally go with the point of view, you know, how can you tell if a politician's lying? Their lips are moving. You know, that this has become an aspect of I'd better say the right thing so that I get the votes, rather than Yeah, we would love to see honesty and integrity and transparency in politics, but it means you won't get power if you do these things. So we seem to have come to a terrible juncture, it seems to me.
I mean, I think that that's one reason why Trump became popular, because he would just say anything. And people thought because he just said anything that he must be telling the truth, because he doesn't care what he says or what it sounds like. But he was the product of, you know, 40 years of right-wing radio. And so all these people were also primed to hear what he was saying and to think he was the Messiah of sorts. But that's, I think, people mistake, like they think that authenticity, first of all, it means that you're capable of being a ruler and being in charge. And that's really not always true. I mean, you do want a politician who is authentic, but just because they're authentic doesn't mean that they know how to rule.
Genghis Khan, I think, was tremendously authentic, you know.
And so, and in some ways, Trump is authentically Trump, even though he lies. But that's really him. He can't not lie. Now, I'm from New York City, so I remember those days where we would. I don't know if I should admit this or not, but we would go to Studio 54, me and, like, because we went to Pratt, so I had a bunch of gay boyfriends, and we'd have fun, and we'd see, like, Donald Trump there, and we just spotted him, like, we just thought, what a phony. Like, how could people be impressed with him? He's, you know, we'd, like, make fun of him behind his back. He didn't know. So it wasn't mean or anything like that. He wouldn't care. But, anyway, I don't know where I was going with all that, but about the politicians, you know, and the authenticity and how that's what they saw in Trump. Like, oh, he's got to be good because he's not a politician. He's not lying. He's authentic.
And he has locker room talk, and he's quite open about his contempt for women. So we can trust him.
Okay, you know, he does that, but he's going to be real.
Yeah, and I mean, one of the things that I don't think I've really seen mentioned, and as I say, I watched a tremendous amount of documentary material about Donald Trump, but nobody mentioned Norman Vincent Peale during those conversations. And the idea that one of the significant cult leaders of the 20th century, one of the most influential cult leaders, a man who sold, it's reckoned, 2 million copies of The Power of Positive Thinking. That's who Fred Trump, you know, went to worship with. So you have this really, you know, and it's a doctrine that we find again and again and again, the secret, the law of attraction, Christian Science, Scientology, places where you're told that the world is bent according to your will, that what comes to you is what you intend. Now, this is abject nonsense. Anybody who can think surely understands that you can't have this one little planet floating in the great infinite sea of space where 7.5 billion people are all having their wishes come true, positive and negative. That can't actually work. But people get hold of this because it's a nice, simple idea, like the idea, you know, some of the ideas Hitler had about you know, Jewish people all have lice, the lice are giving us disease, and 45% of medical doctors in the German-speaking world joined the Nazi party. 45% of these highly educated people were willing to believe this nonsense.
45% joined what?
The Nazi party.
Oh, the Nazi party, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, look, Hitler was, he was Trump on steroids in a way. It's all about emotion. And once emotion, I mean, he was emotional. And, you know, Germany had been beaten badly in World War One, and they were all pissed off about that. So they were susceptible. And here comes this guy who's acting angry. Maybe he really was angry, but this is what the right wing does, like Fox, the pundits, they act angry. Mm. And so he was able to convince people, because people were able to put away their rational thinking because he set their amygdala on fire. I was going to say something else about that, but I don't remember what it was. So he was able to convince all those people. I was thinking primarily through his use of emotion and repetition and boiling things down to something simple. Did you know that when he met Goebbels, they were like, they kind of like fell in man love?
Something like, yeah.
Yeah, like they met and they felt all this kismet. Mm. And the two of them were you know, fed off of each other, and then just created this brainwashing machine in a way.
And of course, in Germany at that time, radio was the dominant medium. Yes. There's no TV.
Yes.
They controlled cinema completely, and made lots of films, which people have forgotten about. It's not just... Right. Lenny Riefenstahl's Triumph of the Will and Olympia. There are all the Ice Maiden movies and all of this kind of thing, promoting this culture which they saw as being a healthy culture. You said that Hitler was like Trump on steroids. In fact, both Trump and Hitler are amphetamine users. With Trump, it's Adderall, and with Hitler, it was Pervitin. In fact, a few days before he killed himself, Hitler threw his doctor out of the bunker because he realized that he'd become addicted to amphetamines and cocaine as a consequence of the medical treatment he was receiving. So we have somebody who's, you know, in Hitler's case, who's really completely out of it.
Literally on steroids, practically.
So I think that the principle of saturation, that if, you know, we tend to think that the mind is somehow encapsulated within the body. And I don't think that's entirely true. I think that we are, whatever environment we are in, is also a part of how we think and how we feel. Yeah. And if somebody can disturb our emotions, then our reasoning sinks down and we become, you know, and you get that buzz, you get that adrenaline, you get that, and then the sense of community when there are a bunch of people all hating at the same time. You know, that terrifying piece of film, Madison Square Gardens, I think 1938, where it's on YouTube, where the whole place is filled with brown shirts. Madison Square Gardens, we're not talking about Munich. We're talking about American Nazis getting together. You had the silver shirt movement, the brown shirt movement, and rejoicing in that sort of atavistic sense of community, that sort of animal, you know, surrender to the mob, which carried people on to commit such horrible atrocities.
Right. A lot of that was groupthink. And like you pointed out in your book, it's people's natural desire to want to be part of a group and to not be ostracized. You want to think like the group. You want to talk like the group. You want to belong to the group. And hence, if there's a leader of the group, you don't want to disagree with the leader of the group. You tend to minimize what your objection might be to an idea that the leader has. Groupthink is a very, very powerful thing. I mean, look at crowds. Look at mass hysteria. What people will do in a crowd or a group is not the same as they might do individually. And there can be a type of euphoria with being with a group that you don't get. I know I've been to, you know, a lot of Black Lives Matter demonstrations and different, you know, the Women's March. And there is a kind of a euphoria and that you get. And there's also a strength that you feel and a power that you feel. You feel with camaraderie. So, yeah, your thinking is different.
Very much so. And of course, whether Goebbels knew about Bernays, we do know that Mussolini gave a copy of The Mass Psychology of the Crowd by Gustave Le Bon to Hitler. We also know that Teddy Roosevelt had read this book and was so impressed by it that when he was visiting France, he actually made a detour to meet Le Bon. So this is one of the most influential textbooks of the 20th century. It's not as much read anymore, but and he comes to, Le Bon comes to a rather negative view of humanity, with which I don't agree. He was a genius. He was a remarkably perceptive man, but I think his conclusions are wrong. I think that, as you showed with your dad, that it is possible for people to come out the other side of this and be better for the experience, you know, be able to do something, which is why it's a terrible shame in our society that, you know, we have seen tremendous advances, wonderful advances, that you know, we're a lot more tolerant in some ways, thankfully, than previous generations. And one of those pit parts of tolerance is that if people are diagnosed with a mental illness, we are, you know, they don't become the court idiot to be, you know, made fun of. There are those incredible Velázquez paintings of the men of pleasure, the cretins and the dwarfs of the court of King Philip. And so that's not what will happen, and people will have a certain sympathy for you if you say you have depression or something like that. But there is one group in society, and I'm a member of it, that don't get very much in the way of sympathy. And that is if you say, I used to belong to a cult.
Yeah.
And there's this sort of cookie cutter view of what that means. And one is sort of ostracized because, and those presumptions that we're making when we put that stereotype forward are what we kind of think about what groups do and how people submit to the crowd. Now, I was in Scientology for 9 years. I never submitted to the crowd. I questioned everything I disagreed with. I was shouted at twice. I shouted back. I was never a live-in member. But I, you know, have now talked with hundreds and hundreds of people who went through similar experiences and who did surrender their autonomy. They gave up the locus of control. And it's that doesn't have to be beaten into you. It can just be that you find yourself in that environment. Then the Chinese brainwashing program, a part of it was to, if you were new to the program, then you'd be put in a room with 7 or 8 people who were just finishing. And their last job was to hurl abuse at you until such time as you started to break, at which point they'd be let out. So you have that penetrated Western culture. It's called the hot seat in some groups, but there are hundreds of groups that use this situation of sitting you down and having the whole room abuse you. Synanon, Charles Diederich, used this method with people. Werner Erhard in Est, the original.
Using in a college, you know, in a fraternity.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. And you know, which is something I wrote about in Opening Our Minds, and something that...
That's
a, think of it. Yeah, I remember getting into a discussion with a man who was the head of public relations in Scientology. He's the man who announced Ron Hubbard's death. And he was on a master's degree in philosophy of mind when he was recruited in. And he took real exception to me suggesting that hazing was a bad idea. He thought it was, you know, a normal and proper thing to do to people, to, you know, humiliate them to this level where they would then, and it's a sort of primitive initiation. It's it echoes aspects of earlier human societies and different human societies, where I think the intention is that somewhere between the age of 12 and 14, males should be terrified and then shown that what they were terrified of is not scary. Now, the Apache, I think, used to use rattlesnake venom. And if you survived, then you would find things not as scary. The Cheyenne and the Lakota had their rituals, which would make you into a brave. They'd make you into a warrior so that you would be able to face death. You have the berserkers in the Viking tradition, all sorts of groups where this is happening. And I think there's a kind of remnant of it in horror movies in our society still, that you can be brave enough to watch whatever movie. And I think it's atavistic that there's still some sort of demand for that in our society. And I think that our society feels that it's become effete, it's become weak. And so we then have a kind of libertarian, survivalist, sovereign citizen clique who are not, so there are some of us who are looking forward to a society with, hopefully without violence, a society without rape and rapine, that maybe we could evolve towards something like that. And then there are people who say, no, that's human nature. And, that gave us Hitler and the neo-Darwinian doctrine that it is the bullies who survive, this mistaken interpretation of the survival of the fittest, which was Spencer, not Darwin anyway, but that by fittest, it means those most fitted to survive. It doesn't mean the strongest or the nastiest. But for 12 years in Germany, the schools were pretty much run by the bullying kids. During the Cultural Revolution in China, students were executing their professors. And we've all felt like doing that at some time, but actually doing it, giving this mob frenzy to people to then control them into doing something, which we certainly saw on January 6th. That any film footage of those, that terrible sequence of events that was set up there, that is craziness, where the mob is, they're looking for Nancy Pelosi and Mike Pence so that they can hang them. We're no longer dealing with reasoning. Yeah. And
the only thing they didn't bring was their pitchforks.
Yeah, it's what happens next, isn't it? And it has happened so often in human society.
I mean, one of the reasons, back to the hazing, that groups do that kind of thing is to not just teach the other person, but I think a lot of it is disguised like elevation of the group. Mm-hmm. The group feels like they're even more exclusive, more special. Mm-hmm. We can do this to you, and then you are going to look at us like we're that much more special. So I think a lot of it has to do with that. But yeah, you were saying also in your book that you felt like the cure for this was education. And I do think that understanding the human mind and how it works, and that we're susceptible to emotion. We have something called the amygdala. We have, groupthink. I think if we're taught about things like that, we can be more aware, like, I'm reacting emotionally to this right now. But just like when you get angry and you're too angry, like me, I'll write something out, right? And I write the worst thing, and then I think, okay, I'll wait till the next day. Mm-hmm. The emotion goes. And then you write it with a little bit more clarity and take the anger out of it. And then it starts out this big, right? Then it ends up like, whoa, what's really valid is this. Do you know what I mean?
I do. Yeah. If I feel affronted by something, I try and take 3 days to digest it before responding to it, because otherwise I might get nasty. You know?
I know. I think 3 days is better than overnight.
Well, it's you know, you count to 10. That's the first one, isn't it? So it's 10 seconds. But sometimes with comments on my YouTube channel, that it is very tempting to dish back to people the sort of things they're saying. And over the weekend, we posted a video about Charles Manson, because what is not generally known is that Charles Manson was deeply involved with Scientology. He spent 14 months receiving, while in McNeil Island Penitentiary, he had 14 months during which he received 150 hours of Scientology so-called counseling from a fellow inmate. He also read every Scientology book he could get his hands on. And I didn't, you know, it's not, I've written about this more than 30 years ago, I wrote about it. But since then, a couple of books have been written about Manson. I'm going, well, why aren't they talking about this? And it came up that one of these books, which is called Chaos by a man called Tom O'Neill, I was on Eric Hunley's show, and I'm very deliberately on Eric Hunley's show. He's a libertarian. He's a Trump supporter. And I want to be able to talk to somebody intelligent who has come to that point of view. And Eric is intelligent. So, you know, but we'd done a show, and afterwards he said, did you know that your friend Jolly West programmed Charles Manson? And I'm sort of, did I know what? Oh, yeah, there's this book about it. So I realized I'd bought this book when it came out 4 or 5 years ago. And I'd looked in the index for Scientology. It didn't mention it. I didn't read the book. So if he doesn't know about that, then his 20 years of research is not enough. So now I picked it up and found, you know, 80 pages attacking my late friend, Dr. Louis Jolyon West, who was head of neuropsychiatry and biobehavior at UCLA Med School. And he was not, you know, we weren't close, but I met him 4 times over the years. We spent hours talking. And he was a friend of Martin Luther King. He was involved in civil rights marches. He was an outspoken opponent of the death penalty. And he first criticized Ron Hubbard in 1952, and he never stopped till the day he died, 47 years later or something. And he even addressed the American Psychiatric Association, which heaped awards upon him, saying, Scientology is a cult and its leader is a crank. And, you know, I am not intimidated. They kept suing him. So I'm sort of going, you're telling me that this man was a psychopath. You're telling me that he was a predator, and that if he had indeed programmed Charles Manson, and O'Neill admits that he can't even prove they ever met, then it would have been 2.5 years from a point where they both been in Haight-Ashbury in the spring of 1967 through to the killings in July and August of 69. You say, and there's no record of them meet. So we did a show with Eric and basically said, look, there's no evidence for this. We should be very careful to accuse people of such a dreadful crime without having evidence. And Eric said, oh, Tom O'Neill's now writing a book about Jolly West. And some of the comments were really interesting. There's somebody telling me that I had confirmation bias and I was in denial about Jolly West's real behavior. And it was quite tempting to respond in an angry fashion rather than saying, no, you know, there's no evidence. You know, he's innocent until proven guilty. And I'm taking that position. If you have evidence, please, you know, bring it forward. But it's very interesting. My assistant, Spike, called me up over the weekend, having seen that I'd put this comment up, and told me what a class act I am that I'd managed to respond to somebody in this way. And it is stopping and counting to 10 and going, this is a fellow human being. And yes, they're throwing rocks at me, but, you know, it's up to me whether I dodge the rocks or get in the way and start throwing them back. And what I've generally found is, you know, perhaps 9 times out of 10, if you talk with somebody who's feeling oppositional and you don't megaphone them, you know, and give it back to them, that you can get into a conversation. And if you can get into a conversation, you can arrive at some sort of consensus, which I can't see any other way forward for our species. We're going to destroy the planet if we, you know, for human habitation, if we don't start collaborating and actually understanding that we could like one another, you know, we could get on with one another.
Yeah. I think, you know, when you, I commend you for, you know, looking to speak to people. We need more to these people. We need more people like you to be able to do that. I've tried. I'm not very good at it. But I have some friends from this group, Hear Yourself Think, that are able to do that in a, really in an incredible way. They live in Pennsylvania, and they actually go to these crowds that are standing in line, maybe for, like, let's say Alex Jones or something like that. Mm-hmm. People, but they start out finding common ground, and then that lowers that like deactivates the amygdala, you know, and they find camaraderie about something, and then they start with like Socratic questioning. So, like, what do you think about this, and how did you arrive at that? But not everybody can do that, but that's why we rely on people like you to be able to do that.
And yeah, and the thing is that you have done it, that you've made this remarkable documentary, which shows the process and explains what's happened. And it's for all of us, you know, I do it now through this little YouTube channel and by, you know, publishing the occasional book. I'm working and have been working for a year or two on a book about belief, because I think that's the bedrock, that we have to understand how we've come to believe and how we do come to believe. And I think there's a fundamental principle, William James, in The Varieties of Religious Experience, talks about what he calls noesis, the feeling of knowing, the sense of certainty. And we all do it. The example I always give, I was 17 and a Bible basher was trying to convert me. And we ended up having a 2-hour conversation on the street. And I quoted enough of the gospel at him that he backed away from me, terrified, making sure I wouldn't leap on his back and tear him to pieces. I suppose I thought it had been a very convivial conversation. He was obviously of a different mind. And he looked at me and his parting comment was, "I don't understand the Bible, but I know it's all true." And that's that sense of certainty, those feelings of knowing. And when we examine what we feel sure of, then often there isn't, in fact, evidence, you know, proving that Jolly West ever even met Charles Manson before accusing him of programming him without actually, and I'm sorry about this, I'm sure Tom O'Neill's never going to forgive me, but he doesn't show how Manson was programmed. He doesn't give us the slightest suggestion. He just tells us that he used LSD. And sort of, but hang on, if we're talking about MKUltra and LSD, they found that it's a drug you can't use to program people. It's a drug you can use to confuse people, but no. People's minds tend to change when they take hallucinogen. What the Manson family were actually taking was Datura, which is not mentioned in either of the two books that I've recently read. Manson mentions it, and Tex Watson, who went to prison because while he committed the Tate murders, he was out of his head on Datura, which is a quite different drug.
Yeah, I've never heard of that.
Yeah, and it's amazing because it's not illegal. And yet, in the 1890s, the British India Hemp Drug Commission, which I think is still the largest exploration of drugs known, 10,000 people were interviewed, and they concluded that cannabis should remain legal in India, they could find no harm, that alcohol should remain illegal in India because it was dangerous, and that Datura should be extirpated, pulled up by the roots. And it grows all over the world. It's sold as an ornamental flower, Brugmansia, one of the forms of it. And if you so much as smoke a leaf of it, it can put you in hospital. And I found an ethnobotanist the other week. It was just by chance. I remembered I'd met this guy 30 years ago and still had a mutual friend. And so I asked for an email address, and this wonderful man came straight back to me and gave me a page of description about Datura and what it does. And it basically puts you into another world. It doesn't just distort the world around you as psilocybin, mescaline, and LSD do. It puts you into the nightmare. The idea of writing about the Manson family without talking about them being out of their heads on this dreadful substance, and instead pointing the finger at somebody else, I can't get my head around it, that something so strange would happen. But that too says something, because so many people in the comments, having heard what I got to say, and I read out, you know, there are, I think, five places in his book where O'Neill says, you know, I couldn't prove anything. This is all speculation. I could be overthinking. He doesn't give us one single shred of evidence, really. He gives speculation. He accuses him in an interview of having been the architect of MKUltra, that all 149 projects of the CIA's mind control program come from Charlie West. And then, and this is because he exchanged letters with Sidney Gottlieb, who did head the program. But he didn't know, there's no evidence that he knew that the man who called himself Sherman Gifford was actually Sidney Gottlieb. So we get this web of speculation and then the willingness to believe. And as you say, if we can teach people about confirmation bias, about the fundamental attribution error that we tend to magnify what other people are doing and diminish what we ourselves are doing. You know, if you're late for a meeting, it's because you're trying to spite me. If I'm late, it's because there was a traffic jam, you know. That these normal human ways of behaving, by understanding them and by understanding, I mean, you mentioned the mechanism of agreement where if you want to talk to somebody, you find common ground. Well, that works. And it's used very deliberately by Mooney recruiters, Scientology recruiters, ISIS, Al-Qaeda. I've got in my book, I use the Al-Qaeda list. It's used by hostage negotiators. And it's used because, of course, it's the beginning of a conversation that you want to have rapport. You want to be there with the person. And you can do that because you want to help the person genuinely. Or you can do it because you want to manipulate the person. You know, Charlie Manson's other favorite work was Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People.
Really? And,
yep. I think Carnegie was totally genuine. I think it's a very interesting book. But there's a problem with it, because you're either naturally like Dale Carnegie, who I think, and I could be wrong, but I think he was a good man. And I think he was talking about how he related to people. But if you don't have that personality, then reading the book isn't going to give you that personality, but it is going to teach you how to pretend that personality and, you know, get into the business of selling secondhand cars or religions or guns or anything.
But I pretend to have that personality. Cary Grant said something very interesting about that. He said, I pretended to be me until I became me. And I remember with myself in my early 20s thinking, who do I want to be? I don't want to just, like, you know, happen, have things happen to me. And then I want to be intentional about who I am. And I want to develop certain characteristics and qualities. So that just made me wonder. Like, you can't change the core of who you are, or how your body responds to certain stimuli. You know, you'll always have that. But don't you think you can affect the personality somewhat with a focus, and then you practice and you decide who you want to be? Do you think that's, you know, possible?
Absolutely, I do. Eric Fromm puts forward the point of view that we're born with a temperament and we develop character. That's the way he puts it. Aaron Beck with his...
That would be a good way to put it.
Yeah, and with any luck, you know, and sometimes it can go the wrong way. Aaron Beck, the whole foundation of his cognitive therapy is that by understanding how we're interpreting the world, by listening to what we're saying to ourselves, which we usually say so quickly we don't notice it, that we can then look at our behavior and decide how to behave. That goes a stage further with, say, Martin Seligman's work. And I'm not a big fan of Seligman, I must say, but he's basically, his work on happiness has the idea, his young daughter complained that he was a miserable person and he decided he had to transform himself. And so he learned the cognitive behavioral route, which is that you pretend to be something so you can be something. But it's a matter of who you're pretending to. If you are, and I absolutely agree with you, we should estimate, you know, our own behavior and think about how we would like to behave. So, you know, I think a lot of what happens when people become trapped in authoritarian cults is that they've projected all of the positive behaviors they would like to have onto the leader of the group, without realizing that the leader of the group is usually a much worse person than they are.
Yeah.
And for me, when I left Scientology, I was aware of that in Scientology. You know, within a year or so, I was going, well, you know, I'm treating Ron Hubbard as a hero. Ah, there's something interesting there. What to me would be the heroic qualities? And I left Scientology utterly and thoroughly when I realized that he represented the opposite of the qualities that I believe are valuable. I believe compassion is fundamentally valuable. And he was a man who didn't care about anybody but himself. When his own son committed suicide, he said, well, that's going to get us into a public relations mess.
Oh, my God.
But, you know, how selfish can you get? So, yes, so the point is, yes, by looking at Carnegie, somebody could, you know, a good person could look at that and say, oh, if I behave in this way, then that'll make life better. But it also is a blueprint for sociopaths to find out how they should appear. So, you know, I absolutely accept your point. And bringing people to say, you know, to, if we got kids, to just sit down and say, what are qualities? You know, what do you regard as good qualities in human beings? Is honesty really the best policy? I mean, I'm not a supporter of Jordan Peterson. I don't think he's the worst person in the world. But among his rules for happy living is a ridiculous idea: never tell a lie. Now, you've got Anne Frank in the loft and you're saving her life. Do you go down and tell the Gestapo she's there? Because if you never tell a lie, I'm afraid you have to do that. Incredible simplistic ideas, which are not thoroughly thought through, which, considering he used to be a Harvard professor, is really quite incredible. But there you go. He does have about 20 million followers, you know, so. And there we go.
That's a lot of followers.
Yeah, he's made a tremendous impact on the world. And I think it's because, and it's the Trump phenomenon too, the idea that we can't trust politicians. And so when a billionaire comes along and says, we need to get rid of the billionaires, we go, yes, we'll vote for you. We'll drain the swamp of billionaires, rather than...
It gives a $1 trillion tax cut to billionaires.
Yeah, exactly. And when you look at his whole career from, you know, the Commodore Hotel on onwards, it's just one scam after another. And it, you know, he's held up as a great businessman. And it's like he's got a casino that's grossing more than any other. And he puts two more casinos to rival it in the same place. You're going, that's not really great sense. But then, of course, he didn't actually write the book about how brilliant he was.
Yeah, he's had six bankruptcies, which didn't come out. That was a failure of the media at the time.
It's fake news. It's alternative facts.
Yeah. I mean, they fell down on their job. They were just too interested in this phenomenon. And, you know, it's like staring at a car accident or watching a horror show. And this will entertain people. It's making us money. But he didn't serve the public in the best way. You know, one of the things they could have said was, oh, this person who you think is this great businessman. I mean, there are people who still, I hear people say that. They have no idea he had six bankruptcies.
No, and it is that sense of I will be steered by my emotional conviction. I will be steered by the belief that Stalin is really a good man who is doing the best he can, rather than a paranoid maniac. There's a wonderful film called The Inner Circle, Russian film, and it's about Stalin's projectionist. Mm. And I recommended it to a friend who'd left the upper echelons of Scientology. And he came back and he said that, yeah, there are two things that everybody should see. They should read 1984 and they should watch The Inner Circle, because he said, yeah, the projectionist is there and he's watching Stalin make everybody dance, you know, having getting the Politburo drunk every night and making fools of them. And he's going, what a great man. And then he's seeing that these people are being executed one after another. And he's going, what a great man. And it's so easy to get with the program and to stop thinking, to not be able to stand back anymore and go, hang on a minute, what's really happening here, you know?
The other thing that I don't know if you mentioned it in your book or if I was just thinking about it, but was how people, once they believe in somebody, if they want to, you know, like for instance with Trump, like give themselves over to that person, kind of abdicate responsibility of taking responsibility toward what they do. So it's almost like, well, if that person lies or that person does something wrong, and I follow them, I'm not really to blame because I'm following them. And that's who I'm following, and right or wrong. In a way, it's like, well, it's their fault. They're not taking responsibility because they decided this is my person. This is who I'm going to follow. I believe enough in them that I'm just going to believe and do whatever they say.
Mm. And Nuremberg, of course, this principle was tried. Befehl ist Befehl. Orders are orders. You know, when Goering quite accurately said, I didn't break the law at any point. Right. You know, and it's like, yes, but the law was evil. And a friend of mine has been advising the US military, and they have taken on that not only should you not follow an illegal order, but you should not follow an immoral order. And this is a real transition where saying, yes, but if you did something that harms somebody, then that must be, you know, that moral compass is important. You can't just hide behind the rules and say, and that bringing of responsibility to people, this is part of his doctrine, which he calls courageous followership. He also talks about intelligent disobedience. This is my friend Ira Chaloff. And the intelligent disobedience is such a brilliant idea. He said he was giving a lecture and somebody in the audience said, I have something that demonstrates what you're saying underneath this desk. And so Iris said, what are you talking about? And she brought out a guide dog and said, I'm training this guide dog. And the guide dog has to be trained in intelligent disobedience. If it's a blind person with a guide dog, the guide dog's got to be able to go, you're going to walk into something and stop you. So be disobedient. Why don't we teach our children this? Why are we teaching them obedience so thoroughly when we should be teaching them to reckon not with what does the boss want me to do, but what's the right thing to do? And I think, and it seems very far on in human civilization for this idea to be gradually emerging that we are all responsible for what we do, no matter what.
Yeah.
You know, the president.
If your boss tells you to do something, you know, like jump, you're supposed to ask how high.
Yeah. Yeah. I was very impressed. It was a forensic psychologist called Brian Tully. And he gave a talk this 30, 40 years ago now, where he talked about white collar criminals. And he said, almost every time when he came to interview somebody, they'd say, my boss asked me to backdate a contract for a day, and I did that. And then the boss came along and said, now do a little bit more. And you get the same thing in gangsters, you know, that once you've done something, we can now hold this over you to make you do more. You are now under our control. And so that giving away, you know, the increments of dissonance, the giving away our power over anything, we have to be careful. We have to be able to think twice, to step back from things and to talk about things. So, you know, not signing contracts without having gone away and talked with our spouse about it is quite a good thing. My dad was a salesman. He was a very intelligent man. And like your father, he spoke many languages. I think he ended up with 9 because he learned Russian at the end of his life. He's a very smart guy. But a salesman came around and sold him double glazing for all of the windows. And we had to sit down with him, this was many years ago, and say, this is a bad idea. And thankfully, we have a what's called a cooling off period in this country where you can revoke a contract within 7 days of signing it. And it was interesting to see that, you know, I call it the inertia principle. Robert Cialdini, who is far wiser than I, calls it consistency or commitment. It's the sunk cost fallacy, throwing good money after bad. Once we have elected to follow somebody, as you say, we'll keep doing it. And it's inertia. Once we've started moving in a certain direction, we just keep moving in that direction. And so teaching people that it's okay to stop, you know, if the book you're reading is boring, you can put it down. You don't have to finish it unless you've got a term paper or something to do on it. But
It's like teaching consciousness. We need to be taught consciousness, how to be conscious and how and really kind of how to think. I think that, and then also we need media literature desperately in schools. How to interpret media and how to tell when they're, how to examine it, how to find sources, how to double check, you know, with sources, how to check that you're not reacting or believing something because it hits you emotionally. You know, all of this stuff and how to balance a checkbook should be taught.
And instead we have this sort of 19th century idea of geography, history, math, English, you know, these, as if these subjects were somehow separate from each other. And we've lost, it used to be in the curriculum, it went out of the curriculum in the UK in the 1950s because Latin used to be taught. And that meant that people had to read Cicero. And that meant they encountered rhetoric, the idea of analyzing, evaluating, and articulating ideas. There's none of it left. But I do hope sometime before I die to actually finish a course for kids, because I think that's the important thing. I worked for many years on people's recovery from coercive control, exploitative persuasion. And it can take years for people to get back what they've lost. It takes a few hours to show somebody the basic methods that are employed by by groups to recruit people and to maintain their membership. And yet our educational system has almost none of this. And it's fascinating material. I had the great privilege of talking to some senior high school students in Oregon about a month ago. And to my delight, the guy teaching, this wonderful guy, got hold of me the next day and he said, "I've never seen students so compelled." This subject matter is so incredible, that what we're dealing with, it's like, and that's what education should be. It should be something where, you want to leap out of bed in the morning and go to school because it's such an exciting place. And for some reason, that's certainly not the response I had to school. So grim and dismal,
Yeah, the first class that I took where I was really excited in high school to go to that class and to learn more was sociology. That was like, yeah, this is kind of the stuff that I think about. This is a good class.
Yeah.
And I learned about hypothesis and proof and the kind of data that you really need before you can actually prove a hypothesis. That's like important stuff to know. That helps you discern the truth too.
It's vital.
People did a study. Okay. They studied five people and they came up with the conclusion that blondes indeed have more fun. Mm. Well, all five people were blondes, or five people. How where were they from? All from the same block, whatever. Mm. It doesn't count. That is discounted. Mm. So, that to me, that was like the best class that I took in high school.
Mm.
Science art.
And it's pretty much the area that we've both found ourselves working in helping people to look at social formations and understand how these things happen. Well, we should really wind things up because
time, I guess.
It'd be very easy to just sit here and talk for the next 5 or 6 hours. But what I'd like to do is I've actually ordered a print copy of your book because I hate ebooks. And when I've read that, I'd like to come back to you and talk about that, if that's all right.
Okay, I'd be really curious what you think of it.
Yeah.
I really go into the conspiracy. I shouldn't be calling it a conspiracy because that'll turn people off. But there are theories and then there are real conspiracies. And this is one that everybody should know about. But, there's also the psychology and the tactics. So I'd be very curious what you thought about my breakdown of tactics. And I was actually, I brought up your book and I copied certain segments of it into a document. And then I brought up my tactics sheet. And I'm like, crossing them, like, oh, this is related to that, and this is related to that. Mm-hmm. So, that would be nice.
Yeah, we'll get into that at our next meeting. That'd be fantastic. And thank you so much for taking the time. It's a wonderful documentary. It's on YouTube, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
And are you all right with it being on YouTube, or did somebody steal it from you?
Actually, when I found first, people were telling me, hey, your documentary is on YouTube. My producer, Adam Rankoff, and I, we were writing to YouTube saying, take it down. Mm-hmm. Then finally we wrote to our aggregator, which was Gravitas, and they're the ones that distribute it on certain streaming platforms. And they said, oh, yeah, we forgot to tell you we have a deal with YouTube. And they pay, whatever, 7 cents or whatever it is, So it's cool. But it's strange that they even changed the name, like brainwashing. They made it two separate words. I don't know if you noticed that.
No. That's...
Change the title a wee tad.
It's appalling. Things that people do. So I absolutely recommend documentary. People can go and view it. You don't even have to pay the 7 cents. The advertisers pay that. And very important to understand that it isn't just some kind of Machiavellian Svengali process that's going on here. This is how we behave normally. And that's, you know, that's what I came to as a conclusion, that there are ways of amplifying that and, you know, pushing people along, isolating people, all of this sort of stuff. But we are being tremendously influenced by whatever information we're surrounded by. And if our news sources are deceptive and slanted, and there will always be a biased news, that's inevitable. But if we are being presented only with alternative facts, or lies as they're also known, then we will start believing. So thank you very much, Jen. It's been a wonderful experience meeting you and talking with you, and I look forward to doing the same again soon.
Thank you, John. Yeah. I enjoyed it very much. This was fun.
It was. Grand.
Hi, John here. Thanks for watching. We'd appreciate it very much if you would click like, as well as subscribe, and click the bell for notifications. Every dollar helps, and we welcome new patrons on Patreon, or you can make a one-off payment with any currency through PayPal. Thanks so much.